Tuesday night, October the 20th, 1981. Truth for Today Bible class. And tonight, we take up in Isaiah again where we left off last week. That's in chapter 23. And we left off with verse 14, so we're ready for 15. Verse 15, Isaiah 23. All right, it's about Tyre, and so we have it mentioned here. We've been talking about Tyre, and we explain a little bit about the city. We get a little more of it here now. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years. According to the days of one king, after the end of 70 years, shall Tyre seem as an harlot. Well, there's a little controversy about that 70 years and about the one king. Now, if you read in there one dynasty instead of one king, why, you'll have it. That's all that the difference it makes. It doesn't mean one kingdom, because it couldn't be that. Now, this one kingdom that's talking about here, dynasty, has been a long, long time in existence. And there have been a great number of kings. But about 496 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar became the king. And it's his dynasty that is talking about, and it includes himself and his son and his grandson. Now, his son was Nabonidus, and his grandson was Belshazzar. And you all remember the incident of Belshazzar and the writing on the wall. Now, there's 70 years on Tyre, whether or not it began with the same year that Jerusalem was taken by Nebuchadnezzar, I wouldn't know, but probably about the same time. And if not, the end is the same end as Jerusalem's captivity anyhow, and some others that are mentioned along with it. So that 70 years would run from 496 B.C., and that would make you about 426 B.C. for the ending of it. Now, the end of that dynasty of Nabonidus and Belshazzar, with Nebuchadnezzar to start, the end of that was the night of the writing on the wall. That was when the Babylonian Empire fell to the Medo-Persians. They took Babylon, the capital. Daniel was there, and so you find the account of it in the fifth chapter of Daniel. Now, Nabonidus had gone out with his army outside of Babylon that night. He'd been out for some time and left his son Belshazzar in charge, co-regent with him. And so that is one reason why that he was there, and why critics for a long time said there was no listing of a fellow by the name of Belshazzar in the dynasties of, or in the kings of Babylon. Well, the critics always get left out when they get into, when we get records and so on. Finally found a prayer that Nabonidus made for his son Belshazzar. Found it written, found it dug up, and so we have evidence, finally. Well, we don't need all of that evidence, of course, for our Bible, because we know it is true. And I've often said that science and the Bible agree all right. Science just, Bible just tells us what the science has found is right. We don't need science to help us with the Bible, you know. Well, That's a little bit off the subject in a way here, but I'd like to get a little background on some of these things. And so it says that Tyre would be forgotten 7 years. And then it says, at the end of the 70 years, shall Tyre sing as an harlot. Well, she had been before that. That is, she had been a heathen nation, ran after idols and so forth. And that was the description. And she would return to that same thing. She did return to prosperity. In fact, she got destroyed again by Alexander, and she returned again to prosperity. But finally, faded out of the picture. Nothing there left but a bare rock now, as the prophecy said there would be, as we have spoken of before. And her merchandise and her hire. Oh, wait a minute. I better get back up here. And it shall come to pass after the end of 7 years, the Lord shall visit Tyre, and shall turn to her hire. And did I miss some yet? Yes, I missed 16. All right. I better be watching my place, I guess. Maybe I better mark it. Take an harp. Go about the city. Thou harlot that hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody. Sing many songs that thou mayest be remembered. In other words, comparing that city with an harlot, and she'd been forgotten. Now she has to make herself known in her restoration, so she goes out and sings and so forth to advertise. That's just simply a comparison. And it shall come to pass after the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth, as she had done before. And her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Lord. Now there's a little note that comes in that is prophetic. It is true that Tyre, after this, after many years, did turn to the Jewish religion and became sort of a suitor. But even after Christianity came on, Tyre was a sort of a central place and had a number of bishops and so on sent off from there, if you read your church history. So it became a center of Christianity at one time. So this is prophetic. It shall not be treasured nor laid up, for her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Lord, to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing. So the end of Tyre is not going to be so bad prophetically as we thought, but she was finally destroyed. And of course, the fishermen lay their nets out on the rock where she was once built. Now, chapter 24. We have been taking up from chapter 13 up to here, several countries and the woes pronounced upon them and so on, and what is going to happen. Now, after we get those taken care of, in chapter 24, it takes up Israel. Now, it isn't going to be very much different from what the rest of them were. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. Now, when it talks about the earth here, it is particularly Palestine, Israel's country. And when the world is used, why, it's the inhabitable world of that time. But the earth is especially the, in most instances, the promised land for Israel. And so here's a prophecy. The Lord is going to make it empty, make it waste, and turn it upside down, and scatter abroad the inheritance thereof. Now, we had a prophecy just before this of what had happened to Tyre and the 70 years. But here is the same event that's going to happen to Jerusalem as did to Tyre, except Jerusalem will be first. Babylon will take it. And in all of that taking and so on, the earth, the promised land, will be empty. And it did grow up to briars and brush and so on for 70 years. It was a mess when they came back and tried to work it again. Made it waste, turned it upside down, good descriptive words, and scattered abroad the inhabitants thereof. And of course, the reason why it was waste and so on is because the inhabitants were all taken away. Nobody there to till it. Nobody to look after it. Verse 2, and it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the servant, so with the master, as with the maid, so with her mistress, so with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him. Makes a nice little parallel here. In other words, this scattering of the people and being their captivity and so on, there's going to be no respect of persons. That's what I was trying to tell you. Very poetical way of putting it. And of course, Isaiah probably is one of the best poets in the Old Testament, with the possible exception of David. The land should be utterly emptied. He repeats himself, uses different words and so on. It's making him emphatic. And utterly spoiled. For the Lord has spoken this word. God has said so. Isaiah could prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord. Would that there are more prophets today who could say that. The earth mourneth and fadeth away. That's the land of Canaan. The world, the inhabitable world, languisheth and fadeth away. The haughty people of the earth do languish. And it was a bad time for nations, there's no question about that. A decline, like a decline we're probably in at the present time among the nations. Seems to me that they're sort of a low ebb. Don't know if there are any exceptions. They're having the same political troubles, the same religious troubles, and having the same economic troubles. The earth, Palestine, also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinances, broken the everlasting covenant. That's why that they have to suffer, because they have not obeyed God. Now, we have remarked before that in God's dealing with Israel, the main thing that he was requiring of Israel was obedience. In their testing, especially in the wilderness, they were not punished for their immorality. He wasn't looking at that. He was looking at their obedience. And of course, if they were obedient, the morality would take care of itself. Immorality always comes after disobedience. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell in are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. The new wine mourneth, the vine languisheth, and all the merry hided do sigh. Well, no. What little wine they made wasn't much good then. And of course, nobody would take care of the vineyards and weren't very many grapes. And so all the people, that is, of those who are left there who are merry-hearted, why, they're not merry-hearted. They sigh. The mirth of tabrets, that is, the drums, ceaseth. The noise of them that rejoice endeth. The joy of the harp ceaseth. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. And, of course, if you read explanations on this and so on, you know anything about wine, all I know is about what I read about it. I read some commentary on this, and, of course, you can't always trust that, but they seem to know how wine made the commentator anyhow. I don't. They said if it was kept too long, it would turn bitter and like vinegar, so maybe that might be it. At any rate, it's going to be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down. Now, here is another name for Jerusalem. The great city of Zion is called a city of confusion. And there's another place that's called even something worse. It's called Sodom and Gomorrah. Because of wickedness. Every house is shut up, that no man may come in. There is crying for wine in the streets. That is, for joy or sorrowful. Wine is sort of a symbol of mirth or joy. All joy is darkened, the mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. And that was true when Nehemiah finally heard, after he'd been taken captive a long time, he finally heard that the temple had been destroyed, the gates had been broken down, the walls and so on. He didn't know that for many years. No word came that he could hear. When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as a shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. Then, they that shall lift up their voice, they shall sing for the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Gonna be a happy ending to it. But 70 years is a long time. 70 years without a temple. 70 years without work for the priest to do. No sacrifices. No atonement. No keeping of the Passover. And not only that, but they even forgot their language. And when they came back, and Ezra wanted to read to them the law, he had to translate it into their language, new language they learned. And so there started the Chaldean paraphrase as we know it today. They knew the Chaldean. Well, that was quite a transformation for people in 70 years ago. A lot of things can happen in 70 years. A lot of progress or the opposite. Wherefore glorify ye the Lord in the fires, even the name of the Lord God of Israel, in the isles of the sea. Now in the fires, I don't think I took a look at that, or maybe something on the note on that, or is there? Yes, is an indication of it. I didn't see it. I didn't do it. And the isles, of course, are sometimes coasts, and sometimes they are just, the coast has it, the idea of it, countries that border the sea. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs, even glory to the righteous. Why, that's quite a change from the beginning of the chapter, isn't it? And there was, when we read the history of their coming back, rebuilding the temple and the city and so on, there was a joyous time. And it lasted just about as long as an ordinary revival lasts. And that's about 30 years. And at about the end of that 30 years is when the last book of the Old Testament was written, Malachi. He tells us what had happened. We hear no more of Israel, except in a few other histories. No more Bible written until the Lord came. But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Well, it's I think he says here in the note, I was looking at something else. He says a few three times in the former portion, and here, and twice in the latter portion of the book. Leanness. Of course, now when we speak of leanness, it has an idea of famine. Like down in Egypt when they had a famine down there, and it was signified in the dream by the lean cattle that came up out of the river, seven of them. And it's used over and over with that idea. Fear and the pit and the snare upon the inhabitants of the earth. Now we have something here we have to sort of take up. Maybe better take the next verse and then we explain it. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit. And he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. For the windows from on high are opened, and the foundation of the earth do shake. Now they had three different ways of catching animals. Well, two ways, really. The fear there, the terror, is when they are strung up on ropes or something, some glittering papers and so on, and flutter in the wind, so and scare the animals. And they would look at that and run, and then they fall into a pit. Now, that is a big hole dug in the earth and covered over some light brush and so on, leaves and so on, so that they wouldn't see it. They'd run right into it. So the idea was to scare them so that they'd pay attention to that, and they wouldn't watch where they're going, and they'd run right into the pit, right along the path. Otherwise, they might not go into it. Then it says that those who get up out of the pit, they'll get into the snare. Well, now they also had another way. They would stretch nets around several men and around where there's some animals. And they start drawing these nets in further and further until they had them entangled and caught. So if you get a little explanation of that, how they did in those times, it helps us to understand what it's doing here. Now, this is the things that comes upon Israel, the fear like this, and the snare and the pit and so on. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. Of course, we see it all of that is an exaggeration, we say. And that is poetic, of course, poetic license. But he's describing what it'd be like to people. Now, we read it calmly and coldly in the history book, and doesn't affect us much. If we had been there and had seen the suffering and seen the condition of the country and so on, it would be an entirely different thing. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage, and the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. Well, it'd be a new one. Very, very descriptive. Well, now you see we had some of this confusion and so on. Then we had a little promise of what would come someday. Now we come up on it again. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, that is, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. He punished them. Now, you know, it's strange. Some people just can't understand this. Why the God would use Nebuchadnezzar to punish Israel and turn around and punish him for meddling with Israel. Well, if he's an unbeliever, God can do anything he pleases. Remember that when Pharaoh dared to lift his hand against Israel and kill the little ones and so on, and refused to let them out of the country, then God could use him for an example. He had made his choice. He had hardened his heart. So God hardened it all the more to make him an example to the nations. And so we have this happening over and over. We don't understand that in these days, I know. We hear in the news now all the time about people getting arrested and putting them in jail and prison and so on. And we hear an awful lot about their rights. Far more about their rights than you do about the rights of their victims. Isn't that right? Well, now, if a man has transgressed, does he have any rights? That's a question. And if Nebuchadnezzar made war against God's people and took them captive and so on, does Nebuchadnezzar have any rights? It's God's people. And God had made a promise to Abraham. He said that if anyone would curse his people, God would curse him. And if anyone would bless them, God would bless them. Well, I think we get some warped ideas about these things sometimes. And we may have a tendency to sympathize with Nebuchadnezzar. Well, he was one, maybe the only one about that I know of, that God did work with until he came to the place he did acknowledge the God of heaven and did away with his idols. But it took about three experiences to bring him to that. He saw Daniel free in the lion's den. He saw the three Hebrew children, companions of Daniel, in the fiery furnace. He saw that, but still he just thought that Israel's God was greater than his God, that was all. But finally, when he ate grass for 7 years and came to, then he acknowledged there was a God in heaven who made kings and unmade them and so on. gave all the glory to him. The idols are gone. It takes that sometimes to break some people. We can take it right in our own lives as an experience of our own. We may make a profession, as Nebuchadnezzar did, but still hold on to our old idols, our old sins, and so forth, like he did. But the day has to come, finally, if we're ever going to make any progress, then we have to fully acknowledge him, and the rest of it goes. And sometimes we get right to the end of our rope before we'll do that. No way out. No other way out. We can get hedged in. Well, that's a little sermon in there for free. And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit. Now, that's another kind of a pit for prisoners. And shall be shut up in the prison. And after many days shall they be visited. Now, probably you don't realize what all is said here. But it was pretty much of a custom back in those days that when they shut up some prisoners, especially prisoners of war and so on, put them away in a prison and just forget them. They had no redress. They had no way of communicating with the outside and so on. And the ruler forgot them. Maybe someday he'd remember them and start looking after them. Of course, the keepers had been all the time looking after them and feeding them and keeping them safely confined. Then the moon shall be confounded. Well, I guess that's a pretty good word. It says in your note, you're blushed from shame. And the sun ashamed, turned pale from fear. Well, I wonder what all that picture's in. Well, we do have a prophecy, or whether this has anything to do with it or not, it's rather questionable. But we have a prophecy in Matthew 24 that says the great tribulation will be so bad, so harsh, that if the days were not shortened, no flesh should be saved. That's Israel. And we go back into the book of Revelation, find the description there of the great tribulation, and it says there that the one third of the sun or the day would be smitten, one third of the night would be smitten, or one third of the moon, and so the days are shortened. For the day then would be one third shortened, and would be instead of 24 hours, would be 18 hours, or 16 hours, which our astronomers say was what the length of the day was before the flood. So it'll be a returning to that condition. It'll be getting ready for the millennial kingdom where they'll have pre-flood conditions. And so the moon shall be confounded, the sun ashamed, when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem and before his ancients gloriously, or the elders. And gloriously, of course, is in his glory. Well, now, that chapter 24 is divided into two main parts. And we notice the first part was the troubles that they would have, and then a prophecy of relief, and again it takes up the troubles they would have, and ends up here with the glory that should follow. If you sort of follow some of the structural outlines you have in your companion Bible, you can get quite a bit of help on these too. Well, we'll start with chapter 25. Now, here is the first verse. Just doesn't seem to have anything to do with the rest of the chapter. It just must be that Isaiah had to say something. O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will praise thy name, for thou hast done wonderful things. Thy counsels of old are faithfulness and truth. Well, that says a lot, doesn't it? And he says, thou art my God. And the only God that Isaiah had, too. I'll exalt thee. Well, of course, if you know God, you're going to exalt him. You're going to praise him. You're going to tell something about him. I will praise thy name. You know, it's a very common thing today. It's the rule that people who profess to be Christians, they don't talk about their God. They don't go about exalting him. They don't go about praising his name. In fact, that's the last thing to talk about. In many of our modern assemblies, there are certain things that are taboo to talk about. Even religion and politics. You're not supposed to talk about those things. They're controversial. And you find that especially true in all of the social organizations that people have, their clubs and whatnot. That is one of the rules, that you don't talk about politics and religion. So if you're going to have a testimony, it's not going to get him mixed up with those things of the world. You won't have any testimony there. Might as well get right out on the street and pick them up out of the gutter and have more of a testimony. For thou hast made of a city an heap, of a defense city a ruin, a palace of strangers to be no city. It shall never be built. Well, strangers are foreigners, of course. And here is a city, a heap. Well, let's see. Therefore shall a strong people glorify thee. The city of the terrible nations shall fear thee. For thou hast been a strength to the poor, a strength to the needy in his distress, a refuge from the storm, a shadow from the heat, when the blast of the terrible ones is as a storm against the wall. Thou shalt bring down the noise of strangers, as the heat in a dry place, even the heat with the shadow of a cloud. The branch of the terrible ones shall be brought low. Now, I wonder who this is talking about. Did they think that their city never be rebuilt? Oh, give it away, don't it? Jerusalem. It says the city of the terrible nation shall fear thee. Strong people glorify thee. Yes, there's a time coming, and there have been times in the past, when Jerusalem has been known all over practically the civilized world. Now, don't get me wrong about that word civilized. That sort of slipped out of my mouth. Because we have our own idea of civilization entirely. Now, civilization, civilized and so on, comes from Latin word, which simply means a state or a group of people. And so, when they get civilized, they divide into groups or nations and so on. And, of course, fight each other. That's the usual result. So being civilized doesn't necessarily mean being Christianized or something like that. Not at all. So let's don't get the wrong idea. A civilization, many a civilization has existed and come and gone without probably ever hearing the God of heaven. I wonder the Hittites ever did. The Amalekites. You can name some of those ancient kingdoms, some of those ancient peoples that were a strong people, had world dominion almost at times, and yet probably never knew God. There's no indication the Amalekites ever did. One of the cruelest peoples this world has ever had any history of. And here's a city that's going to be different. And even during millennial times, it will be a great leading city, a pattern for all the rest. So we have cities that have been patterns in the past, sure. You can name a number of them. Take a Babylon. Take a Rome. Constantinople. Paris, especially for fashions. London, England. So on. Think of all of these great centers that people look to, and with different reasons in each case, of course, not all of them alike. Well, those are some things to think about. Now, six. And in this mountain shall the Lord of hosts make unto all people a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of wines on the lees well refined. Now, when you have a feast, you know it's a time of rejoicing. And, of course, this is figurative. Now, these folks aren't going to be drinking wine all around and getting drunk and so on. That isn't it at all. It wasn't very often the Israelites got drunk. He was a pretty low person if he did. And, of course, you still are. We'll add that. I know when I was a youngster, I wondered why in the world that if a man got drunk and committed a murder or something, they excuse him because he was drunk. I couldn't figure it, and I haven't been able to figure it yet. But I see things are changing a little bit on that. Man's responsible for getting drunk, isn't he? Now, if it's a case of insanity, I might throw a little doubt in there. But for getting drunk, I see no excuse. Unless somebody caught him and poured it down him. All right, so much for that. So verse 6 there shows that there's going to be a time of rejoicing. Now remember that Israel had feasts during the year, times of rejoicing. There were three main feasts. And in the millennium they will still have those feasts. And the nations at that time will be subject to Israel and have to keep Israel's law. Now that's a subject we can take up sometime, but not ready for it yet. We're doing a series on the millennium and TFT, and this will probably be a part of it. There are going to be a number of things that are going to come out on that. I don't know how long that will run, because that's a big subject. Well, I don't want to discourage you, though. For in this mountain, now yes, Jerusalem is spoken of as a mountain, Mount Zion and so on. It is a mountain. It's 2,600 feet above sea level. And that's a pretty good height for as close as it is to the sea level there at the Mediterranean Sea, not too many miles over there. And it also makes it pretty high because it's not only 2,600 feet above sea level, but it's 1,300 feet more above the surface of the Dead Sea. So then to go up to Jerusalem from the Dead Sea, you'd have to make an ascent of 2,600 plus 1,300. That'd be about 3,900 feet, if my arithmetic is right. Batteries are dead on my calculator, though, so I have to use my head. Well, now, if you're going to walk that distance and have to make that much of an ascent, you'll find it going up from Jericho to Jerusalem is quite an ascent. And Jericho is just about down to the level of the Dead Sea. And so when they say go down to Jericho, they absolutely mean what they say. And to walk from Jericho up to Jerusalem, they want to be exercised pretty well for you to tackle that one, because that's not an easy walk. I about lost my place again. Let's see, what verse was I on? Oh yes, 6, 7. And he will destroy in this mountain the face of the covering, cast over all the people, and the veil is spread over all nations. Well, you must see the veil is spread over them. I don't know if there'd be any darker veil, any more terrible veil than idolatry. He will swallow up death in victory. Remember Paul quoting that? And the Lord God shall wipe away tears from all faces, and the rebuke of his people shall he take away from off all the earth, for the Lord has spoken it. God said so. Now, the word Lord there, as it is in the first verse, I didn't explain that even, is Jehovah. These are places where the Jehovah has been changed to Adonai in the Hebrew. So, this is what it is. And it shall be said in that day, lo, this is our God. We have waited for him. and He will save us. This is the Lord, Jehovah. We have waited for Him. We will be glad and rejoice in His salvation. So that's what Israel is going to say. Well, the Lord said He wouldn't come back until they said, "Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." And this is very much like it, isn't it? Looking forward to that day. "For in this mountain shall the hand of the Lord rest, and Moab shall be trodden down under him, even as straw is trodden down by the dunghill. And he shall spread forth his hands in the midst of them, as he that swimmeth spreadeth forth his hands to swim. And he shall bring down their pride together with the spoils of their hands. And the fortress of the most high fort of thy walls shall he bring down, lay low, and bring to the ground, even to the dust." Now just about this spreading forth of hands in the east, their way of swimming was to come down with a spat on the water, their hands reach out in front of them and then paddle, like a dog paddle about. And so you can see the movement as described here in our swimming marathons and so on. We hear these days they don't use that sort of a stroke. We can get there very fast. That's all I know about swimming. I used to, not anymore. Well, now this is very real that he's saying here, and he's saying to Israel quite some time before that these woes happen, especially Babylon taking the land and so on. It's said some time before that. And the people are warned, but I suspect they paid about as much attention as people do today when they're warned about things. It's just business as usual. They go right on their way. Well, just think. Noah spent 120 years building an ark. And the people knew very well he was building a boat. And out on dry land. And that was a crazy thing for a man to do. And with a testimony of 120 years, and that something was going to happen, they laughed and so on. Or 8 souls went into the boat. So let's not be discouraged today if we don't have much of a response to our telling the good news. People are interested in the things of the earth, and they're not going to listen any more than they did then. But let's not be discouraged, on the other hand, like Elijah was. Poor Elijah, he thought he was the only one left in Israel, was a true believer in Jehovah of Israel. And God said, "Now just wait a minute, Elijah. There are 7,000 people who have not bowed their knees to Baal in Israel." Now that's in the 10 tribes, Israel, not in Judah. Remember that Elijah was a prophet to Judah, or to Israel. 10 tribes. A prophet at the time of wicked Ahab and Jezebel and others like them. And yet, there were 7,000 people who had not bowed the knee to Baal. So let's don't get discouraged. We run across some of these once in a while today and are a little surprised. Well, now, I think we will end this part of the session and get ready for our next subject.